Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, the Grenfell Action Group, the terrible fire in London last year. We speak to Joe Delaney and get some of the latest from Ground Zero. Also, the new Chartists. They are Justin Walker and his British Constitution Group, uniting everyone to restore our ancient freedoms, democracy and prosperity. Well, sounds too good to be true, so I quiz Justin about that. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street, and I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show. In November the 20th, 2016, which was about 7 months before the fire, the Grenfell Action Group posted a blog entitled, with a headline, Playing with Fire. They say in that that only a catastrophic event will expose the ineptitude and incompetence of our landlord, KCTMO. They also say a serious fire in a tower block is the most likely reason that those who wield power at KCTMO will be found out and brought to justice. They talk about these landlords as being evil and being unprincipled and being a mini mafia, Joe. They say a future major disaster is likely to happen, and also they say only an incident that results in serious loss of life of KCTMO residents will allow external scrutiny to shine a light on the malign governance of KCTMO. Now, this sounds to me almost like a direct warning saying that this fire could happen, and we believe it will happen, and I find it incredible that 7 months before this can have been publicly circulated, and yet nothing was done, it seems, to make sure that it couldn't happen.
But Tony, the thing is, something was done, because what KCTMO, Kensington and Chelsea Tenant Management Organisation, we call it the TMO locally, what the TMO and the council were doing at the time was slagging off Francis O'Connor, the author of the blog, and slagging off Eddie Dufan, the guy who, the other co-author of the blog. You know, that they were merrily slagging them off left, right, and centre.
Well, when you say slagging them off, what action or words were said against these people who were basically trying to save the 70 or so people that died eventually?
Well, the one communication that Ed and Francis both got from the tower, which I actually helped them out with, was when they received threats of libel action against them for some of the previous blog posts in years prior to the fire. You know, the council were very very keen to protect their reputation even then. TMO staff told other residents of the tower not to listen to Ed, who was living in there at the time. He's an alcoholic. He's a drunkard. He's just scaremongering. He's hysterical. He doesn't know what he's on about. And things like that. You know, that we were told on this estate to accept, you know, just ignore these people. We know best, you know, that's it. So be quiet and just go back to your homes and pay your rent and business as usual.
So how,
it was just sheer arrogance.
So how were these people in a position to manage such a large estate? Because it does seem as if they have absolutely not just disregard for safety, but are clearly attacking in a way, like almost like these whistleblowers are being told, well, you know, you're bringing these issues up, and as a result we're actually going to go out and smear you to try and blacken your name for bringing up basic safety concerns.
Yeah, the reason they were able to get away with it was because it was done with the blessing of the council, and the council were their bosses. It was the council that appointed the TMO to manage these properties, you know, and the TMO had been in the council's pocket since its creation. Its first address when it was created was Kensington Town Hall. It was then based in another office belonging to the council on Kensington High Street for most of its life. And then it moved down to Kensal Road in this area in the last couple of years. That was the first time when it wasn't based in council offices. But they still shared all their back-end systems. They shared the same phone system. They shared the same IT system. you know, and that was it. And the staff, the staff did what they were told. And this is the thing, the council has quite a lot to answer for as well, because where was its due diligence? It had been shown in 2009, a report was undertaken, an independent report, which said that a lot of the information that the TMO had about fire safety and things like that was inadequate or out of date or non-existent. And yet the council still did nothing about this. You know, the only person who could take enforcement action against the against the TMO was the council, and they would never do so.
What about the people involved in this Grenfell Action Group post who had this premonition, were then smeared and then proved right? What's their situation now?
The smearing was happening before that post. The smearing was happening years before that post. The threats of legal action we're talking about, I'm talking about, go back to sort of 2010, 2011, when the regeneration of this area was first proposed.
What's happened to them now? Have they been given some sort of role? Because they were clearly on the case where nobody else was.
Well, thing is, I mean, Ed, the two people behind the blog, Francis is the one who mainly writes, and Ed was sort of the person who'd go out and dig things up. Francis lived in the tower until 2012, I think it was, and then he moved back to Ireland. But he continued to edit, he continued to write and edit the blog. And Ed, who lived in the tower, was sort of the person on the ground who was doing, you know, so he was the one who was talking to other residents in other blocks, talking about other projects in the area where the council were clearly trying their gentrification and social cleansing policies. So like closing down the local college, selling off the local library to Notting Hill Prep School, which it just so happened that two of the senior councillors at Kensington and Chelsea had their kids on the waiting list for. You know, so they were continuing to work in the community and build links in the community and raise awareness. And that was how I was involved with them. It was when this regeneration project was first proposed around here.
So did Ed survive the fire?
Ed survived, thankfully. Ed got himself out, thankfully. It certainly had a profound effect on him, you know. I mean, in a way that it's sort of like you often feel, I mean, I felt this myself, and I've had to come to terms with this. It's like I feel that I should have done more in previous years, you know, even though I'd often help residents with issues and things like that. And I helped quite a few residents. I was head of insurance and risk at a neighbouring borough. So I worked for their council of a neighbouring borough, and I was their head of insurance and risk for about eight, nine years. And I was using my skills from that to try and hold the council and the TMO to account on for residents on an individual basis. I personally helped quite a few residents get thousands of pounds in total of compensation for things that were they dealt with in their own properties, you know, disrepair issues where they've had accidents, or, you know, getting them refunds on rent for time when certain utilities weren't working for them and things like that. Ed was doing his stuff, you know, trying to raise all these issues in the community. Francis was doing his stuff, you know, and we all feel to some degree we still should have done more. You know, and I know it's, you know, the logical part of your brain would say, well, come on, you know, with hindsight you'd think that, and even if you've tried, what would you have been able to do? But frankly, you do feel like, well, look, you know, we're some of the only people who were raising issues and trying to put things right at the time. You know, so we have this burden on our shoulders. And the fact that, you know, there are members of staff at the council and the TMO who were cynical enough to try and edit pages of the website, of their websites in the aftermath of this disaster, but, you know, didn't actually send anyone out to help the people who'd been evacuated and were sleeping rough on the streets around here in the nights after the fire.
Well, I understand.
It shows you the difference between these people.
I understand that also that some of the companies that did the refurbishment, the cladding of the Grenfell Tower itself, I think is it Ryden, one of the companies, another one called Harley Facades, they also did a similar job, which is removing lots of details from their website immediately in the aftermath.
Yes, within 24 hours of the disaster, I believe Ryden's website had been edited. You can still look at it on the Internet Archive. If you go to www.archive.org, you can see the timeline of their website and what changes were made. And it's just that sheer utter cynicism of these companies. You know, the first, when it comes to who are they going to save, the first one they think of is their own, you know, their own slimy reputations.
So where, this inquiry, the Moorbick inquiry is going on. There's also quite a lot of dispute about, you know, what it's looking at, who is involved in the inquiry, to what extent, which is obviously not helpful. Mr. Moorbick, who's in charge of it all, is someone who's a former judge who was involved in shipping people out of London and saying that councils could do that if they wished, which is obviously doesn't inspire great confidence.
There, in Moorbick's defence, that case involved a lady who lived in Westminster. And basically what Westminster Council did was they moved her out to Milton Keynes, I think it was. And she was trying to say, look, this is no good for me because I'm losing my support networks and my kid can't go to school. Now, the matter went to the High Court where Moorbick was sitting at the time. And he found in favour of the council. Now, in fairness to him, because of the way that the law was written, he had no choice other than to find in their favour. Because the law just basically says that the council has to find you accommodation. And so he didn't have the power to rewrite the law. But
could they find accommodation in Australia? Would that be legal?
Well, I mean, this is it. Because of the sort of loose way that the law is written, arguably, perhaps they could. And that was it. It was only when it went to the Supreme Court, because the judges in the Supreme Court have a lot more leeway in these matters, you know, basically, to put it very bluntly, up to the High Court, they have to look at the letter of the law. At the Supreme Court, they can look at the spirit of the law. And it was when it reached the Supreme Court that they were able to get that change. So, I mean, I personally don't hold that decision against him. What I did hold against him, I met him the day he was appointed. I was in one of the first meetings with him down here. And he seemed to be quite open to what we were saying and receptive and everything. But then he went on the media and he said, I don't think this inquiry is going to satisfy people. I don't think the terms of reference will be wide enough. And the problem is that the terms of reference hadn't been agreed at that point. You see, so that gave me concern because it seemed to me that he was trying to narrow the inquiry. I mean, he's certainly a smart man. His areas of expertise are marine law and insurance law. And, I mean, these are some of the oldest areas of law that we've got on the planet. You know, so, I mean, to be an expert in not one but two of these shows, you know, you've certainly got some grey cells upstairs. But I do think that he didn't have the common touch. But in fairness to him, you know, he has certainly tried. It's just a shame that Theresa May has refused to appoint a more diverse panel. Because a lot of the people who've been appointed as evidence assessors or expert witnesses to the inquiry are people who have links in the industry, which we have problems with. I mean, there's a guy called Luke Bisbee who's appointed as an evidence assessor. I believe he's either an evidence assessor or an expert witness to the public inquiry. And Luke Bisbee worked for the Building Research Establishment. And the Building Research Establishment were the people who came up with the supposed safety tests to say that cladding such as this was perfectly safe to use. You know, and Sky News did a pretty in-depth report on that, which basically showed that the BRE has been wholly captured by the industry it is supposed to police. And so what good is it? This is what locals have an issue with. When people hear us say diversity, you know, everyone always assumes, oh, we want a black face, we want a brown face, and we want a Muslim and all this sort of stuff on the panel. You know, that's not what people are talking about. What we're talking about is we want a more diverse pool of expertise to be drawn upon. You know, we don't just want people who are insiders because, you know, they're the ones who basically helped contribute to this disaster.
Yeah. What about the sort of main thing with the Grenfell Tower fire is that there were several sort of tiers of responsibility. We've got the you know, various contractors, subcontractors, Ryden, Harley Facades. We've got the auditors, KPMG of the local authority. You've also got the Kensington and Chelsea TMO, you've got Kensington and Chelsea Council. All of these people are involved in the decisions around the cladding and around the so-called refurbishment of Grenfell Tower. Haven't the police got an absolutely impossible job when it comes to pinning responsibility on one person? Because there seems to be lots of different organisations involved. I wonder if you can point the finger at one or maybe two that you, where you think the responsibility lies.
Well, I think ultimately, remember, I mean, look, the building companies, say like Ryden. Ryden didn't choose what cladding goes on that building, you know? Type of cladding, remember, it's a public procurement exercise. And so because it's public procurement, any project for more than £154,000 has to go out to public tender. Now, the tender documents for the regeneration of that block specified one type of cladding. It was RBKC staff who made it. Well, one of the councillors there, Councillor Rockfield in Mellon, who made the arbitrary decision when he was trying to shave costs on this project to change the type of cladding that was used. So instead of using Celotex FR, which is Celotex fire resistant, they decided to use Celotex SR, you know, which saved them a couple of thousand quid on this. When it comes to stuff, you know, should Ryden have said at the time, well, look, we don't believe that this is a suitable type of equipment, you know, perhaps they should have done, but I mean, I can't really comment on that because I don't know, I don't know enough about that area to say so. But ultimately, I mean, it's the one, you know, he who pays the piper, I think, is the one who should be held ultimately accountable.
The people on the ground, are they disappointed that there have been no arrests? Because 70 people have died.
I think, well, the way we're looking at it is there's been no arrests yet. And so we're still hopeful. I mean, I've seen quite a lot of I've been involved with some of the police investigation myself. They basically, they went to see Francis, who, as I said, is in Ireland. They flew over to see him and they took tons of evidence from Francis, like literally thousands of pages of documents from Francis. You know, so it will take, I mean, even if they were just going through Francis's evidence, it would take them time to run everything, run everything down and check all the leads and everything like that. I would much rather they took their time about this and actually were able to guarantee some decent chances of prosecution and conviction than they rushed in now, you know, managed to mess it up, and then people get away on, you know, legal technicalities.
I mean, surely there's nothing to stop the police arresting people or even just simply asking them to come into the police station to give statements.
Well, I think though, if you arrest people, you sort of put them on guard at that point, don't you? I'd much rather everyone speak as freely as possible. Personally, I'm quite happy to see all of these companies sling as much blame at each other as possible. You know, all of you, I want all of them to sling mud. And another company that you haven't mentioned is National Grid. National Grid have a lot to answer as well because the fire brigade were unable to cut the gas supply to that building for quite some time after that fire broke out. It took at least 12 to 16 hours, if memory serves, before the gas supply could be cut to that building. You know, so how much did that contribute to this as well? So it's certainly a complicated argument. And personally, I'd like all of these organizations to use all of their resources, all of their money, all of their lawyers and everything to blame each other. Because that's it. I'm hoping that if you all sling mud at each other, then some of that mud will stick on all of you and we'll get all of you.
Joe,
the only thing I'll be disappointed about is if we only see corporate manslaughter charges. I would like to see individuals charged with manslaughter as well.
What about KPMG's role? Because we've been hearing in the news recently that they were going over a lot of the documents to do with the refurbishment of Grenfell Tower and involved with the local authority too. So, and they've come in for some criticism recently.
Yes, and deservedly so, in my opinion. You know, I mean, it's a bit of an odd one, isn't it, that the people who pay you to audit them are the ones you're supposed to criticise. You know, what we don't want to end up with in this country is a sort of American situation where certain news organisations won't run stories about certain companies because they're fearful that if they do, those companies will pull their advertising from their channels, you know. And it seems to me to be the same thing. The incentive system that's set up in this country is just so backwards that it's inevitably, you know, is going to lead to the auditors, erring on the side of caution when it comes to criticizing the people who are their paymasters, ultimately. You know, how likely are Kensington and Chelsea Council to re-employ KPMG as an auditor if KPMG sort of castigate them in this year's audit? Because remember, it's up to KNC who they appoint every single year. So the fact that, you know, the revenue stream of an auditing company is wholly reliant on the company that they are supposed to be auditing is a very worrying situation, not just for building regulations and, the Grenfell disaster, but across the UK as a whole. It seems a very odd system to me.
Yeah, and it's not properly regulated either. Joe?
No, it's not. And the Audit Commission's been gutted out, hasn't it? You know, there isn't an audit. We don't have government auditors anymore. I mean, they basically contract out their work to these companies too.
Yes, it's pretty exasperating. Anyway, Joe, where do you think is a couple of the best places for people to follow, you know, somewhere which is a little bit close to ground zero? You know, people on the ground still living around Grenfell and those who have been siphoned off into hotels to get your view of what's an ongoing inquiry, an ongoing investigation. Whereabouts?
People in the community, we still try and stay in touch, even though people are, you know, a lot of people are still scattered across hotels across London. We do all still try and stay in touch. I mean, personally, I'm in fairly regular contact with the Grenfell United group, who represent the people from the tower itself. I work on the Lancaster West Residents Association. I'm on the committee of that. So, you know, I still try and stay in touch with residents. I often help out residents still on an individual basis with issues they're having, accessing services and support. So, I mean, I have to say the community spirit in this area that I've witnessed since this disaster has been absolutely amazing. And I know that we'll certainly be ones who are sticking together throughout this. You know, it's as bizarre as it may sound, it's an incredible bonding experience to have gone through something like this as a community. So, you know, I mean, there may be disagreements, you know, about certain issues as time passes and things like that. But ultimately, we're all still focused on the same thing. We want, we want the people who suffered the most to be looked after. And we want justice for those to be delivered to those responsible.
The Grenfell Action Group that originally warned that this fire would happen, let me just quote them, they actually said this fire will happen on the 20th of November 2016, 7 months before it actually did happen. Do they still exist? Can you follow them on Twitter, Facebook, that sort of thing? Are there any other groups like Grenfell Action Group that people should, you know, check out online, blogs, that sort of thing?
Well, the Grenfell Action Group blog is still going. That's grenfellactiongroup.wordpress.com. You can follow Grenfell United on Twitter. That's at Grenfell United. I'm on Twitter myself. That's at Jodafone UK. So Jodafone. Also, I would urge all your listeners to visit petition.parliament.uk. Type in Grenfell on the search box and please sign the petition that we've set up asking Theresa May to give us a more diverse panel. We're currently on about 25,000 signatures. We're hoping to get it up to 100,000 because then we can force a debate in Parliament. And frankly, I think we need one on this matter because it is such a serious one and it will have such serious implications for social housing across this country. At the moment, also, what else is there that people could look at? Those are the main ones. I would just advise people to be careful about who it is in the local community they're following. Grenfell United is the official group for the people in the tower. You can go to the Residents Association website, which is lankwest.com. That's LANCWEST. We'll always post news and updates on there. Those are the main sources. But yeah, the news one would definitely be grenfellactiongroup.wordpress.com. There is also the Think blog. I don't know the address of that one, but Think, it's This Is North Kensington. So TH for this, EI for is, and then NK North Kensington. That's a blog that's very up and up to date with issues in the area. On the 14th of every month, we do the Silent March, which starts from the local Methodist church and lasts for about 3/4 of a mile. You know, we still have quite a big attendance at those. There's always a couple of thousand people at that every month. And as I've often said, our silence on that march speaks volumes. You know, the council and that would love it if we rioted. And, you know, but frankly, our position is we have the moral high ground at the moment. And we're sure as hell not going to give that up. And we're sure as hell not going to support any individuals or organizations that try and make us lose that. So, you know, we're not looking for violent support at the moment. We need practical support for people in the area. And those are just some of the ways that people can help.
Do you think there's been a certain advantage taken by central government, by the local authority there, because this has now kind of fallen off the headlines?
I think at the moment I met with a member of staff from Nick Hurd's office today. They certainly don't feel that this has fallen off the radar. You know, I mean,
sorry, who's he, Joe, and what department or whatever?
Nick Hurd, he's a Conservative MP who's basically been given responsibility by Theresa May to oversee the Grenfell response from central government. I believe he's MP for? He's MP for somewhere around Twickenham, I think, if memory serves. But yeah, I mean, I met with one of his assistants today, you know. She certainly seems keen to help. The council, you know, have realized as well that they do have to start doing certain things for residents if they want to try and keep this image up of them being caring and compassionate. So, you know, we're certainly keeping on their case at the moment. And I think that the fact that there is the threat of the inquiry and the police investigation and things like that hanging over their head, it certainly means that they're not going to forget their responsibilities in this area for a long time either. I mean, as much as it pains me to say this, this is going to be a long-term issue in this area. You know, we're talking years for the recovery to actually properly, you know, before anyone could properly argue that the recovery has now taken place. And so, you know, we constantly have to ensure that pressure is kept on these people so that they do not forget their responsibilities, and also that they don't think that they can just get away with it. You know, that's why the Hillsborough campaign has been such an inspiration to us, because look, I mean, they've kept this in the public eye for 3 decades. Now, and a lot of that time, you know, it was in severe opposition and with, quite frankly, a huge sway of the public opinion being against them, you know, but ultimately they knew they were in the right and they had the strength, the courage, the tenacity to keep this thing going. And frankly, they've been an inspiration to myself and quite a few other people around here. I certainly hope that we can show the same sort of strength of character and patience and persistence that they, and frankly, sheer bloody mindedness that people such as Sheila did in order to keep this campaign in the public eye. I mean, obviously it's not going to be something that will make the daily news, but we will always ensure that if there are significant events, that we do try and get the spotlight to focus on those events. Because this is an issue that matters to everyone in this country. It is something that is so critical. We cannot have a government that thinks, you know, that thinks that being captured by private industry and basically just, you know, submitting to the whim of whatever private industry wants and whatever they lobby for the hardest is the way that they will always stay in power. And we cannot have local councils who seem to forget that they are there to serve the interests of their residents. They are not there to serve private interests themselves. Particularly, you know, with matters such as Brexit coming up now, where it looks like there could be a risk to certain legal protections that we have in this country. You know, everyone needs to show their elected representatives look, if you aren't doing what we want, we will vote you out. You know, so believe me, however much you might get paid by Company A to do whatever Company A may tell you to do, you have to remember that when it comes to the election, we will vote you out. You will lose your job, and then you won't be able to do anything for anyone. And I do think a lot of the time, particularly with the way that our electoral system is designed in this country, many MPs just don't feel that threat. That was why even before the disaster around here, it was seen as such a huge shock that Victoria Borick, who was the Conservative MP in what was considered one of the safest Conservative seats in the country, Kensington, lost by under 30 votes to Emma Dent Code. So the next time anyone ever says to you that their vote doesn't count, just remind them of that fact, that the Tories lost one of the safest seats in this country by just 28 votes, I think it was. You know, so if just 28 people around here hadn't bothered to turn out and vote Labour, we'd still have a Conservative MP in this area.
Well, it might even be, Joe, it might even be that some of those people were Grenfell Tower residents that are now not with us.
Indeed, but I certainly do hope as well that whereas people would often vote along party lines in the past, you know, I mean, since this disaster, I've met Conservative councillors who I can work with. I've met Labour councillors I can work with. I've met, you know, Green Party councillors and MPs that I'm happy to work with. Frankly, I'd be willing to work with any party of any political persuasion whatsoever, as long as they are working for the genuinely working for the interests of those who they are meant to serve, and are interested in actually ensuring that we see justice for this Grenfell tragedy. Because it is outrageous that at least 71 people died because of hubris, greed, and frankly, incompetence on the part of those who we all assume would protect us.
Joe Delaney there from the Grenfell Action Group.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Justin Walker, and I've been involved with the British Constitution Group now since its foundation about 9 years ago. And the British Constitution Group was set up to make the British people aware of the common law heritage that we have, and to remind people of the importance of the Great Charter, Magna Carta of 1215, and all subsequent common law acts and so forth. And we are trying to bring the present regimes, and that's probably the best word to describe them, to task, because they are trying to airbrush the common law out of British society and replace it with Roman civil law, where you are guilty until proved innocent, as opposed to the other way around. Habeas corpus is suspended, and you've got politically appointed judges acting as judge and jury.
Now, okay, but, you know, when I was at school, I was taught that Britain doesn't actually have a proper written constitution.
Yeah, that's part of the problem. We have a very fine constitution, so fine that the Americans borrowed it, and the Australians have used it, New Zealand, Canada. We have a common law. The Magna Carta, the Great Charter, is the fundamental part of it. But we also have the Declaration of Rights in 1688. And, yes, it's in different sections. It's not one written document.
Okay, so what's the difference between common law and statute law? That's the laws like the Terrorism Act, which actually would probably break many of the stipulations in Magna Carta, for example.
It does. Right. A statute or an act is passed by Parliament. It is, as I said, Roman civil law it comes under. It can be quashed by common law, because what people don't know is that a jury of randomly selected people, if somebody is brought to trial on a statute or an act that they consider to be unjust and unsafe, they can find that individual not guilty and so annul that legislation. In other words, if a randomly selected jury of ordinary people consider legislation to be flawed and not fit for purpose, they can annul it. Now, the parliamentarians won't let you know that. nor will the judges allow the juries to do it. The simple fact is that we, the people, are ultimately sovereign, not Parliament. With all that's going on with Brexit and Remain and all the arguments, Parliament believe that they are sovereign. In the current debate over Brexit and stuff, they've announced, you know, that they had that court case. Yes, we, Parliament, are sovereign. We have the last day. No, they do not. We, the people, have the last day, because a jury can annul bad and flawed legislation passed by Parliament. If a jury of randomly selected people consider that legislation to be not fit for purpose, they can annul it. And the parliamentarians don't want you to know this, and even the judges don't want you to know this.
Well, what about Roman law? You mentioned Roman law. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, that's 2,000 years old, surely. No, or maybe 1,700 years old, because we've had the Normans and everything since then. There's no Roman law left in Britain.
No. Roman civil law is how it's done. It's called other things. It's sometimes called Napoleonic law. Sometimes it's called mercantile law of the sea, it's sometimes known as, because the common law is the law of the land. So the merchant's law, that is what operates in Europe. And to give you an example, as I said before, you are guilty until proved innocent, which is quite the opposite of the common law. You have no habeas corpus. In other words, you don't have an absolute right to the due process of law. And you also have politically appointed judges, or if you do have a jury, it is controlled by the judge. Whereas in our country, a judge is only there, and this is something our judges don't want to let go of. Judges, in fact, are only there to ensure a level playing field between the prosecution and defence.
Okay, so you're starting this thing called the New Chartist Movement.
Oh, yes.
What is that all about, and who were the original Chartists?
Right, well, the original Chartists appeared on the scene in 1836 and were around until about 1848. Now, basically, Parliament up until then was only a Parliament of landed gentry. You had the Whigs and the Tories. The Whigs were the radicals to some extent, but still landed gentry. And you had the Tories who had, well, not dissimilar today, but they too were landed gentry plus aristocracy and the merchant class. So essentially, people in Parliament were people of money and people of influence and people who owned land. You also had things like rotten boroughs, where, you know, you could find, I don't know if people can remember that wonderful Blackadder, when a rotten borough, where I think it was Baldwick put up as candidate, and there was only about one person voting. Now, it's exaggeration, but essentially you had seats in Parliament where only very few people actually could vote, and more to the point, their vote was controlled by the local mayor, the local lord. And so they were known as rotten boroughs, and so Parliament did not represent the people. Now, what the Chartists wanted to do was, first of all, they wanted all people to have the vote, but they accepted at that time it would have to be for men only. So a vote for all men over 21, and they didn't have to have landed qualifications. In other words, a vote for all men over 21. A secret ballot, so that people could actually put down what they really believed without being pressured. No property qualification to become an MP. Payment for MPs, mind you, with what's going on at the moment, we sometimes think they're snouts too firmly in the trough now, but nonetheless, in those days, this is to ensure that ordinary people could become MPs. Electoral districts of equal numerical size, so obviously to get rid of the rotten boroughs. And the sixth one is the one that we're actually considering should be started again, and that is to have annual elections for Parliament. Because what they don't like are people who settle down for a political career and then become virtually immovable and just become part of the furniture, and more to point, they serve the elite and don't serve the people who put them there.
Well, they'll say, of course, that 1 year is not enough. You need several years in order to put long-term plans into practice. So one year is simply not enough. You just get started and suddenly you're removed.
Well, I'll come on to that later on, if I may, Tony, because this is something which is what you might term work in progress. But the other very important, in fact, those are the six requirements of the original Chartists. Now, today, the six requirements that we have, first of all, we want to see the full supremacy of our common law, the trial by jury common law, which we've already discussed, and therefore confirming the Great Charter. Charter, and that's obviously why we're calling ourselves Chartists, because we refer to the Great Charter as the focal point of where we come from. So we want the absolute right of a randomly selected jury to annul bad and flawed legislation and so forth.
Talking about Magna Carta here, can you just, before you go on, can you just say something about how that came about in the first place and when it was?
Right, Magna Carta. People, again, history has distorted Magna Carta. The Great Charter came about because you had King John, who was a lawless king. He was a king who was behaving beyond his remit. You see, what people don't realise is that when the Saxons were around, kings were actually elected. They were a bit like presidents. You had to basically go before the noblemen and others to be elected. You didn't have a divine right by bloodline.
That's the Witan, isn't it? The Witan? The Witan?
Yes, you had the Witan, which I have to say, we'll come on to that later on. I'm sympathetic to some sort of committee again of some wise people who have no vested interest and actually go where common sense is. But we'll come on to that later on, because I also want to see possibly the process of randomly selected people coming into Parliament rather than political careerists. But let's move on to the Magna Carta. So you had, in effect, a lawless king who was operating outside what is sometimes termed natural law, divine law, the law of the land. And that, as I said, is... And by the way, trial by jury goes right back thousands of years. This is not something that was peculiar to England. It happens in Germany, Scandinavia, everywhere. You have tribes and what have you. The actual law, the idea of juries assessing the evidence and coming to a decision of randomly selected people within the tribe or within the community, the town, whatever, was accepted practice right across Europe and everywhere else. So it's not just peculiar to this country. Anyway, King John obviously misbehaved. The barons were getting very upset with the fact that he was doing unpleasant things to their wives and taxes and God knows what else. But what people don't realise is everyone thinks the barons met at Runnymede and forced his hand. So it was basically the aristocracy who were going to lose out if he carried on. It's not quite that simple. Baron actually means, in old French, free people. And in fact, townsfolk, admittedly was a feudal system, we can't deny that, and you had people, serfs, and they were, you know, attached to their local lord and what have you, the manor and so forth, yes. But there were an awful lot of free people in the towns and merchant class and so forth, and they were included with the barons because they wanted to assert these freedoms. And those freedoms, as I said, come right through today. You are innocent until proved guilty. You have the right to the due process of law. In other words, you don't just get locked up and get left in there. You have randomly selected juries, and you have properly professionally appointed judges to oversee the justice, to make sure that the juries can arrive at their decision in a fair way. But this is the interesting part. Originally, the juries decided the punishment. Not the judge. The juries assessed the punishment on hearing the case. So that's something that should be reconsidered.
Well, no, I've diverted you away from talking about your new Chartists. Can you carry on with taking us through some of your more up-to-date demands?
Okay, well, that's the Great Charter. So the Great Charter is absolutely key to what we're doing, and that's why we're calling ourselves Chartists. Now, the other thing which is absolutely crucial is that there is a fiscal process which is now known as sovereign national credit. This is whereby the Treasury creates, issues and controls all the money that is needed by the country. Now, this is something which was tried out in 1914 by the British government with the Bradbury Pound, and it worked extremely well. It stopped the collapse of the financial city, the City of London. It stopped a complete financial collapse at the outbreak of the First World War. The principle is very, very simple. It is that, like we have the gold standard, where, you know, how much gold you could then, you could issue amount of money based on that gold you held. So it was worth something. Well, the sovereign national credit is about creating money that's based on the country's assets, what your country is worth. Currently, we are worth around about £8 trillion, according to the Office of National Statistics, with a further £17 trillion, which is your labour potential, your creativity of your labour, which can be thrown in. So in other words, you draw money based on your wealth, OK? done by Abraham Lincoln during the American Civil War in 1862 with the greenback dollar. It was done in Guernsey to rebuild Guernsey after the Napoleonic Wars. There have been many occasions, even Adolf Hitler. How on earth did they go from the Weimar Republic of hyperinflation when a barrel load of paper money was used to buy a loaf of bread? Suddenly, they were building autobahns and they were suddenly preparing for war. How did they do that? Because Hitler's bankers, the central bankers were largely dismissed, and Hitler, through the German treasury, created paper money that was based on the labor that people put into the Reich. So if you worked for the Reich, you got paid in money, and everybody accepted it. What we've got to remember is, what is money? Money is simply a convenient unit of exchange for goods and services that people have complete confidence in. That's all it is. There's nothing more complicated than that. So,
I mean, what about something like Bitcoin?
No, don't go anywhere near Bitcoin.
But some people do, and they have confidence in it, don't they?
Because they don't understand the central banking system. They don't understand how the 1% who are dictating terms to the rest of humanity, how they do things. The simple rule is this. If something is simple, it means it's usually the best way and it's lawful. When something becomes complicated, then you know the crooks are making their money somewhere along the line.
Well, I wondered for a long time, Justin, how come you knew so much about the money system? I mean, it's a kind of a black art, isn't it, how it all works?
I'm going to have to come clean with you. My late uncle was a director of the Bank of England, okay? And another director of the Bank of England 5 years ago who worked with my uncle, he was on his deathbed, and his son rang me, and essentially the conversation was very brief. And he said he didn't disclose who he was, but he'd read an article of mine in the UK column when it was a newspaper rather than the programme that goes out online now. When it was a newspaper, I wrote an article based on the American Civil War, the greenback dollar, and I said, why on earth can't we have a greenback pound? Why can't we just create the money based on the wealth of the nation? And this phone call was very short, and he said, if I researched the Bradbury, he didn't say pound, he just said, if you search the Bradbury, my father says you will find the solution to all of Britain's economic woes. It's the big secret they don't want you to know.
So tell us a bit more about this Bradbury pound.
Okay, the Bradbury pound. Right, First World War, outbreak of the First World War, everything was gold standard. Obviously, with the tremendous threat that the First World War offered to stability and market stability and currency stability, people were worried. And they thought, with the uncertainty of war, especially in Europe, I think we'll get our gold out. I think we will take our notes along, which are Bank of England notes, or, you know, to the banks, and say, I want my gold out, please. Now, at the time, the British Bank of England only had 9 million pounds in gold. Now, of course, 9 million doesn't sound much today. Bear in mind that £1 in 1914 is the equivalent to £107 today, so it's actually a bit more. But nonetheless, it was nowhere near enough to stop a run of the banks. So the bankers went running to David Lloyd George, who was the Chancellor of the Exchequer then, and said quickly, we've got to implement, and I think they'd already discussed what they were going to do, because they'd had plenty of build-up from the assassination of the Archduke Sarajevo. There were a few weeks, so they obviously knew things were happening. And some people say that the bankers behind the scenes were actually happily orchestrating things, because let's face it, a war is very good for banks. The preparation for war, the governments are borrowing, the actual fighting of the war to pay for munitions, and then the rebuilding afterwards. So wars are extremely profitable for banks. So anyway, so they met the Chancellor, and he implemented immediately the Currency and Exchange Act of 1914, and in 2 days it was rushed through Parliament. And this authorised the Treasury, not the Bank of England, the Treasury to create money, paper money, that was based on the wealth of the nation. And so they introduced in 4 or 5 days, because the banks closed on August the 3rd, bank holiday, and they reopened on the 7th. And when people went into the banks with their gold, they wanting their gold out, they were given these certificates. They were given Treasury notes in £1 and 50 pence or 10 bob, denominations. And as I said, £1 in those days was considered to be £107, today's value. And they were given these notes, printed on one side only. The first batch were printed on stamp paper on one side only, because they were rushed through. But later Bradbury pounds were very professional and looked like ordinary banknotes, but they were issued by the Treasury. And they issued 300 million of these, £300 million worth, in 1914. That is the equivalent today of over £30 billion.
So, I mean, so is this Act of Parliament still on the statute book? Could they do this today?
It's on the statute books. It's probably been repealed, you know, because, I mean, obviously they've gone back to the status quo, because this is where the story gets interesting. David Lloyd George then, you know, he was going to be able to fight a war by drawing from the wealth of the nation. Not taxing people, but drawing from the state, from the wealth of the nation. But the bankers, when they realised that the banks were safe and the run of the banks was not going to happen, went running back to David Lloyd George, and he immediately said, OK, I will go back to what we normally do. That is, I will create bonds and sell them to the private financial sector. You will buy them at interest. Obviously, you will, you know, we will have to pay you interest for buying them, so 3.5%, 4.5%. And it got back to the old story of the government having to borrow money from the private financial sector as well as taxing people.
Well, it does amaze me, really. Why doesn't the government actually print its own money? Why does it constantly have to go to the city and say and borrow money from them?
You've hit the nail on the head, Tony. This is the reason why the Chartist movement is going to exist. It is so easy to understand. But let me just return quickly back to David Lloyd George. So he suddenly did a complete U-turn, went back, he stopped doing the Bradbury. It wasn't stopped immediately. It was phased out. In fact, the last Treasury note for the Bradbury, as it was called, because, by the way, I didn't explain, the reason it's called Bradbury is because Sir John Bradbury was the first Secretary to the Treasury, and he signed the notes. So that's why they were known as Bradburys. And in fact, I actually have a book, a Punch book, of the First World War for 1914. And Punch actually wrote a poem to the Bradbury, thanking for the saved salvation of the nation, the Bradbury pound. So anyway, the Treasury started to run these out. And the last Bradbury came out in about 1926. So they still produced some notes, but they went back to creating bonds for the private financial sector to buy. Now, this meant, by the Treaty of Versailles in 1919, which was the peace treaty that brought the First World War to the end, the national debt in 1914 was £650 million. Again, multiply that by 107. Okay, it's quite a lot of money. But when the war finished, the debt had gone up to £7,500 million. Again, multiply that by 107. And that's when the national debt became a real problem. So the bankers, when they realised they couldn't make a killing out of the killing on the Western Front, managed to persuade David Lloyd George to reverse the decision. And the big question that nobody can answer is, why did he go down that path? What blackmail? What was it? Why, you know, because Lord Rothschild and others really laid into him. He was put under a lot of pressure. Some say he was secretary and to the Zionists. I don't know the full answers. We're still trying to work out why he did a complete U-turn. Interesting, by the way, I asked Dan Snow on Twitter, the historian, the TV historian, who is very good, I have to say, but I asked him on Twitter, I said, do you know about the Bradbury? He didn't want to respond at all, which is unusual, because he responded to one or two other things.
Well, no, I've heard the similar things about anything interesting and controversial that is it rocks the establishment boat. Dan Snow doesn't want to know, so he's basically a historical gatekeeper.
Yeah, well, you know who Dan Snow's great-great maternal grandfather was? David Lloyd George.
That's all for this week. Dial X Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen to the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Joe Delaney from the Grenfell Action Group and Justin Walker from the New Chartists, the website newchartistmovement.org.uk. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the national volunteering website do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.